Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday are some fabulous people, Drs. Malcolm Payne and Kimberly Sampson. Both are obstetrics gynecologists practicing at Southwestern Vermont Medical Center in Bennington. Dr. Payne earned his medical degree from the University of Glasgow in Scotland, but don't worry, you'll understand him. He completed his residency in obstetrics and gynecology at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. Dr. Sampson earned her medical degree at St. Matthew's University of Medicine in the Cayman Islands, lucky her. She completed her residency at Mount Sinai Hospital and Medical Center in Chicago. Drs. Payne and Sampson, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you very much. It's great
to be here. Thank you, Alan.
You guys are great. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Here's a question. We have calls coming in already, but I wanted to ask you, what's the relationship between the obstetrics person and the pediatrician? When does the pediatrician take over?
So I think it very much depends on an individual situation. We certainly have a very good relationship at SVMC with our pediatric team. We have a very extensive list of different providers. So they certainly need to be called in at different times. All the way through the pregnancy itself, we have a very good relationship, and we often advise our patients to sort of reach out and be in contact with the pediatrician throughout the pregnancy.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because my boy, who is now 41, who had an Apgar score of 0 or of 1, swallowed, and who is a PhD in brilliant, had a swallowed his meconium in when he was there, and then there was this, you know, sort of running around at the last minute when cesarean was performed, and so the pediatrician, and a wonderful man, and the obstetrician had to sort of lay out who was doing what.
Well, we're very lucky in that we have a very good team of pediatricians, and we always have someone on call. So if we anticipate any problems, if we see meconium fluid, for example, ahead of the birth, we try and anticipate that and have the pediatricians present for the delivery. So
there's a handoff. Is that what you're saying? You know, once the baby is out, it's the pediatrician's deal.
Yeah. So, I mean, when the baby is inside, then it's we have that mother and baby. And we have to look after both of them. But as soon as the delivery has happened, then usually there's a pediatrician available very quickly if we need them. So we're lucky in that sense.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question real fast, and then we can go take some telephone calls. 1-800-348-2551. And that question is, I notice you're a guy, and I notice your partner here is a woman, doctor, and that there are two other women in the practice, right?
That's correct.
So you're the sort of odd man out.
Correct, literally, yes.
You know, in this. So you know, what's that? Do women necessarily want to see only women in gynecological practice?
I think it's great that we have the opportunities for people to choose. Certainly in terms of obstetric patients, we make it very clear that we have both male and female providers, and most patients are completely fine with that. So I think it's important.
But there are women who want men. Yes,
I think there are. Yeah,
definitely.
I think there are.
What do you think that's all about?
I think it's there's definitely a generational effect. There's also it's a personal preference, and that goes along the lines to the fact that even that the females will have different personalities, and people nowadays they have the choice.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I'm more of a Freudian myself. I would like to figure out what's going on here. So 1-800-348-2551. Jim and Matamoros, welcome back to the program.
Barring any obstruction to the birth canal, is Pitocin or oxytocin still used in dystocias?
I have no idea what you've just said, so maybe somebody else will sort of help me with that.
So we do use, if there's an indication that labor might be slowing down or there's an abnormal contraction pattern, we do use oxytocin. It's always something that we use with caution because it can cause risk to the mother and the baby. But yes, it is still used.
And what is it?
So oxytocin is a artificial synthetic equivalent of the of the hormone that's produced to cause uterine contractions to propel the baby through the birth canal.
Does anybody ever stop in the middle of a thing and say, you know, okay, the baby's not coming out, we have to do a cesarean now, at the same time the baby is sort of halfway into the birth canal or coming through? Is that an unsophisticated, stupid question? Or, in other words, you ever take the baby and say, okay, we're not going to, that baby's not going to make it out here, we have to do it another way?
Yeah, definitely. There's a time and a place when we certainly have to call a cesarean section. I think all the providers pretty much sort of err on the side of caution. We want to make sure that we have a happy, healthy baby, but we also need to respect that we need to attempt to have a vaginal deliveries at times, and sometimes we have to switch over to a cesarean.
And Kimberly, if I may call you that, I remember there was a point at which that we were having a lot of cesareans in this country. Is that still the case, or is that number going down? Does anybody know?
No, I think it's certainly coming down. Yeah. Again, there's trends. We certainly need to we have guidelines that we follow. Again, everything is an individual. We can't blanket everybody in the same sort of scenario. Every patient comes in, and every labor is different. Every baby is different.
Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. I was thanking Jim from Matamoros. Yeah. 1-800-348-2551. Cheryl, you're on. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, good afternoon. Hi.
Good afternoon.
You're on.
Thank you. Could I get the doctor's advice for someone who is 47 and still very regular as far as a monthly cycle? What their best idea would be for birth control at this age?
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for your question. There's many different options for someone in that sort of position, and I very much would suggest that you would speak with your individual physician. But we sort of need to take into account many different options for yourself. The average age here in the US is 52 for menopause, so I certainly understand that with somebody with regular cycles that it can still be a concern. Now, things are very much moving towards some of the longer-acting reversible contraceptives that we have. They're very appealing to many women in the fact that they can also help with our cycle control. But they're also very, very effective contraceptives. But it's something that we definitely would recommend that you would speak to your individual provider to discuss and tailor towards yourself.
So what are they like? What are these long-term?
So you may have heard of the IUDs.
Sure,
also have implants that are also a progesterone only, so they're very tolerated by many women. Can certainly be one of the most effective contraceptives that we have at this point.
So Cheryl, anything else on this?
No, I had heard about an IUD that was a hormone-free IUD that sounded like it might be a good idea.
So it's Cheryl. Certainly, there is an IUD that doesn't have hormones in it. But again, it needs to be tailored towards the individual. It doesn't work for everybody, so I certainly would suggest that you would speak with your provider.
Thank you. You're fascinating. Okay, Cheryl, thank you for the very good call. Appreciate it. Oh, wow, a lot of phones ringing up now. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Sweating.
Support comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in makeoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. healthquest.org/VBMCortho. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. The Habitat for Humanity Restore, 70 Fuller Road, Albany, offering gently used furniture, appliances, building materials, and more. Donations accepted, habitatcd.org/restore. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. newpaltz.edu/theatre. And from Bodhi Spa, Yoga, and Salon, Hudson, with a full-service hair care salon offering color, cuts, and blowouts. Open daily, bodhiholisticspa.com.
We are back with two brilliant doctors, Malcolm Payne and Kimberly Sampson, obstetrician, gynecologists, and they speak with English accents. So that means they are really, really special. So so thank you guys for being with us again. Phones are loading up. There are two free phones right now. Use them. 1-800-348-2551. Lisa in Cambridge. Go, Lisa.
Hi, you were talking about C-section rates, and I was actually wondering about induction and if that is something that, since talking to my friends, most of them have been induced. So just wondering if that is something that's happening more often, and if so, why?
I think induction rates definitely, thank you, by the way, for calling. It's a great question. I think induction rates are very different between different institutions. So it's probably, if it's something that's concerning you, then I would definitely, you know, look at the individual rates for the hospital that you are dealing with.
It's time for me to ask a stupid question. What's an induction?
So an induction is the process of artificially getting a mother into labor before she is going into labor spontaneously. And that can either be for you know, for various medical reasons. Sometimes it's because they've gone far past their due date. Sometimes it's for complications of the pregnancy.
Ah, okay. And did I interrupt you? Probably.
No, it's a good question. So I think, as I say, I think it varies between different institutions. And it's certainly, if it's a concern, you know, then I would definitely raise that with your provider at whichever institution they practice. What we do when we look at patients in general is we always try and balance risks and benefits for the mother and the baby. So it's typically a conversation that we would have with the patient about, you know, why we might think an induction would be raised. For example, as I said, it could be because their blood pressure is elevated or various different reasons for induction. So it's always a conversation we have with the mother and try and get the balance right for her and the baby.
Now, Dr. Sampson, why do we do inductions in the first place? Is it serious if the child won't come?
So as Dr. Payne says, there's definitely different reasons for it. I personally had an induction for both of my babies, so
really?
I certainly can sympathize with the patient there, that it is sometimes challenging to understand the reason why the doctor wants to do it. But I think that's certainly why that's part of our job, is to sit there and explain the reason why. You know, sometimes it is medically what we would consider necessary. We would recommend that the baby, you know, would do better on the outside than on the inside at that point.
But not because the doctor is late for lunch or something.
Yeah. Definitely not. Yeah. Definitely, babies come on their own schedule, even when we're doing an induction.
Right. And are you surprised, guys, when a baby takes much longer than you thought or comes right away? I mean, is it?
Again, every baby comes at its own time, other than when we do the C-section, obviously.
Yeah.
But no, they certainly, you know, we can't plan it. Mums can't plan it most of the time. And that's part of the things that we do as an OB.
Yeah, I think it's always something to, you know, we always try and manage people's expectations and just give people kind of realistic expectations that it can take a very long time. So
see what you started, Lisa. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much.
So actually, I just had one more comment. So it's interesting that Dr. Payne said that that's a conversation he has with his patients, because Dr. Payne delivered my son over the summer. And Alan, to answer your question, you said earlier about people preferring male doctor over female doctors. I don't have any preference at all. However, when he told me that the doctor's name was Dr. Payne, that was a little more concerning than the fact that he was a man. So
I love it.
It was a great delivery, so I just wanted to call that. Thank you.
And you did a great job. Thank you, Lisa.
Well, thank you, Lisa.
1-800-348-2551. Three free phones. We'll go to Elizabeth in New York and Vermont. Okay, go ahead, Elizabeth. You're on.
Hi. I'm trying to figure out how I would get an answer about what seemed to me to be dystrophic changes, or perhaps even a dangerous anomaly, within the vulval urethral area. Not ever having been the age I am, I have no clue whether this is just normal aging I'm seeing and normal deterioration, or if it's a result of having topical hormone treatments due to a misdiagnosis years ago, in which clobetasol was mandated for a great length of time until two other doctors said, no, you do not have a condition that warrants that. And do you recommend, is there a really great urogynecologist in the area that I could go to? You know, I don't spend my life kneeling over a mirror or any such thing, but when you have discomfort and things are going wrong, you try and say, what's going on there? Help.
Well, I think the first thing I want to ask the doctors to do is explain some of the terms you were using, because I'm not totally familiar with them. So the anomalies, doctors?
I mean, there's certainly multiple different conditions that can arise on the vulva. There can be skin conditions that are specific to the vulva and are also general that can be found elsewhere and also occur on the vulva. There can also be other age-related changes relative to the menopause, relative to childbirth. So there's many, many different conditions that can be seen there. Some of them can be treated with clobetasol. Some of them use other treatments. So I think I would definitely encourage anyone with concerning symptoms to see their provider and have them do an examination, which I think would be the best first step.
I have done that, and they don't see anything.
Okay.
And my concern was, is the speculum in the way so that they're not seeing what I'm seeing? Because what I'm seeing is almost like a crimson, tiny look of a bead near or even within the urethra, and I'm seeing what I think of as like striations, and I don't know if that's the muscle walls, that the walls are so thin now and so unplump because of age, that between the speculum and just the awkward position you're in, that perhaps things are being missed.
I mean, what you're describing in the urethra certainly may be something like a urethral caruncle, which can be normal, but equally there are many other conditions that could be described. I mean, I don't know which is the nearest specialist hospital to you, but I mean, there are different specialists in both in Albany and at Dartmouth who we often refer patients to. So that would also be another option for you.
Where do you live, Elizabeth?
Basically on the border, just about into Vermont.
Okay, great. Thank you for the very interesting call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, and so that's it. Right, for now, we got 5 free phones. It's up to you. You want to use them? Use them. 1-800-348-2551. And coming in over the email, hi, how is the field of obstetrics changing, or is it, to accommodate the needs of older women, especially the baby boom generation? Who wants to answer that one first? Okay. Dr. Sampson?
So I think there's many different things coming across in our sort of field. We're certainly seeing a lot of, like you mentioned, the baby boom. We're certainly seeing a lot of patients increasing with age. We're certainly trying to sort of pay attention to sort of the symptoms that they're having through menopause, for instance. Mm. And everything, again, has to be sort of tailored to the individual. But there's certainly lots of different things coming through in regards to hormonal replacement, things that we can use topically that are definitely available. So
somebody calls up and says, you know, I'm a 45-year-old woman. I have 40-year-old children, so I see them as very young. So is 45 old now?
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. We're certainly a large portion of our population, of our patients, are definitely going to be in that sort of age range. So.
Because people are marrying later, having babies later?
Exactly. Yeah, I think the a recent statistic said that the average age of first child is up at 26 now. So.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Now, here's one I have no understanding of what it means. It says, can you talk about VBACs and the risk associated with them? What's a VBAC?
So it actually stands for vaginal birth after cesarean section. So somebody that's previously had a cesarean section, for there's, again, numerous reasons as to why they may have had it.
Right.
But it's the attempt, a trial of labor after cesarean, also called a TOLAC, which then results in a vaginal delivery.
So what's the reason for that? Why would we want, why not a second, cesarean?
So there's, again, a time and a place. It's definitely a patient choice. We have to sort of, we have set criteria to see if they can actually, has the potential for a vaginal delivery, including how long it was since they previously had their old incision. So we need to make sure that there's an extended window to allow adequate healing. We need to make sure that the baby is doing what it needs to be and is in the right position. So by that, we mean that the baby is head down.
Okay, so if you see a baby imaging head up, is that a real crisis?
So by that we mean that baby's bottom is coming first, or legs are coming first, or an arm, or back. And there's many different presentations that we can see, but we want the baby to be in the best birthing position possible.
So, I mean, again, I think this comes back to the question that was raised earlier about concerns about rising cesarean section rates, and there was a big push a number of years ago to try and combat that concern, and the old saying, you know, once a cesarean section, always a cesarean section, is really not true anymore, because there's very good safety data that it is very safe for women to attempt a vaginal birth after a previous cesarean section.
And what was the concern, that there would be a tear in the incision?
Yeah, so there was concern that that previous scar on the uterus was a weak area, and that would result in danger for the mother or the baby.
How do you know in the middle of the birth what to do? I know this is a dumb question, but how do you know what to do next? I mean, you know, there are all kinds of things that can happen. They can throw you all kinds of curves in this thing.
I mean, some of that is training. Some of it is experience. One just has to really expect the unexpected. I mean, part of the satisfaction of the job is being able to anticipate various different outcomes and then handle those in the moment. It's a demanding specialty, but it's certainly extremely rewarding for that reason.
Now, moms used to die in the old days. You know, I used to read about it all the time. There were people who died in childbirth. Is this something that is still a concern to us? Do we still see a lot of it?
We don't see a lot of it, but it'll also always be a concern. Certainly, the rates have dramatically fallen, but it's something that we always bear in mind, that we have the advances in medicine, we have the new techniques, we're trained to be able to anticipate some of these things, and certainly that's, you know, not the anticipated outcome, and that's why we work together so closely as a team with the pediatricians, with the anesthesiologists.
So what would be a concern for you guys going in? In other words, high blood pressure, a patient with really high blood pressure, or what other things?
So we certainly see people with high blood pressure very often, and we're well trained to sort of manage that and to recognize it early. But other things that are sort of concern, we need to make sure things like placentas are implanted in the correct manner. Previous C-sections, for instance, the number that people have had, we certainly sort of bear that in mind as well.
Come back to that for a second. What's a placenta? Not what is a placenta, but what do you mean? It has to be positioned.
So the placenta implants in the uterus, and there's certain instances where it will implant, and for instance, impede the baby's delivery. It may be in front of the baby with something we call a placenta previa, sort of covering over the cervix. There's other times where the placenta can sort of implant through the uterus, and those are things that we are sort of trained to detect and look for and sort of manage accordingly.
Huh. Anything to add, Doctor?
Well, I mean, as Dr. Sampson said, I agree that we're fortunate in that maternal deaths are very rare events in this country these days. They're still much more common elsewhere, but it's, again, something that does occur occasionally, and certainly bleeding is a cause, and even early pregnancy, ectopic pregnancy, is another one of the more common causes. So unfortunately, mothers still do die, sadly.
So we'll go to Maggie in Olive Bridge. Okay, Maggie, you're on.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a call for an older woman, which would be me. And I'm curious about stress urinary incontinence versus urge urinary incontinence for a postmenopausal woman who's about 58 years old.
Thank you very much for calling. It's certainly can be difficult sometimes to to tease out the difference between those two symptoms. And in generally speaking, they can have different causes, and sometimes you can find both of those together. So typically for most patients, the approach would involve talking with the patient and trying to get their symptoms clarified and doing an examination. And sometimes it can involve further workup with a specialist such as a urologist or a urogynecologist who specializes in incontinence treatment.
I wonder if a person feels pretty sure that she's suffering from urge urinary incontinence, I guess I'd love to hear what symptoms you might think would be assigned to one versus the other.
Mm-hmm. So typically, the kind of questions we would ask patients would be, so would one have leaking when you are coughing or sneezing or running, for example? Mm-hmm. So that would be more the stress incontinence. In terms of urge symptoms, those would be when you have a full bladder, if you are unable to hold your urine and you have to go to the bathroom immediately, or, for example, something we called key in the door, where you are coming home and you're literally putting the key in the door to open, and then your bladder is contracting and you feel like you need to go to the bathroom straight away. Sometimes it can be confusing, because you can also have urge symptoms that present as when you're coughing. Even that coughing can then cause the bladder muscle to contract, and so you can also have urgency symptoms that are disguised as the stress type symptoms as well.
I see. And the other part of my question then would be, for treatment, if a person had urge symptoms, would there be a non-surgical treatment that could be helpful?
So, I mean, again, it's something I would definitely encourage you to talk to your provider about. I think in general, urge incontinence is best treated non-surgically. If one is fairly certain that it is urge symptoms, then medical treatments or physical therapy can often be very beneficial for that rather than surgery.
Okay, listen, Maggie, I'm so sorry, but we got all these other people. You started this rush here.
Yay!
And I thank you so much for calling. Thank you, Maggie.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll go to Kelly in Albany. Okay, Kelly, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling to see what your thoughts or experience are with working with doulas during labor. I had both of my children at home because I didn't want to be in a hospital environment, but if I were going to do it in the hospital, I would have done it with a doula. And in the Capital District, we're very lucky to have lots of doulas and midwives and different birthing options. So I just wanted to see what you guys thought about that.
Okay, Kelly, because when my kids, my daughter had a doula, I had no idea. I never heard the word before. So could you define what a doula is?
A doula is a person, usually a woman, not necessarily, but a person who is a labor assistant. They're not a medical professional. They're there mostly to support the laboring woman and her partner, if there is a partner, with comfort measures like massage, and also helping a woman to advocate for the labor she wants and make sure that she doesn't have the interventions that she doesn't want to have during labor.
So, Dr. Sampson, do the doulas ever get in your way?
No, I think actually Kelly put it quite perfectly. I've actually been very lucky to work quite closely with many doulas throughout my experiences here. And she put it exactly right. They're there as a support person, and certainly so long as they understand their roles and we understand ours, we can certainly work together very well.
Well, what happens if there's a real emergency? You know, do you ever have to just sort of push somebody away?
So, as Kelly said, they're not medical professionals. So there is, again, a time and a place where we would certainly need to do our job. And they're there as a support position for the patient.
Anything else, Kelly?
No, thank you guys very much.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You, Kelly.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to, what does that look like? Val? Yeah. Val in Albany. Okay, Val, you're on.
Hi. I'm actually, sorry, my name is Vi. I'm a medical student, very interested in going into OBGYN. I'm a third year, so I'm just about to do my rotation. And I was just curious to hear from you what your thoughts are about the field. I've gotten a lot of mixed reviews about going into the field, mainly due to lifestyle, things like malpractice, quality of life, whether you can have a family. And I'm obviously still very interested, but I would love some advice and to hear your thoughts about that.
We're both very lucky. Thank you for calling, by the way. We're both very lucky because we both have families, and I think it's definitely possible to achieve the right work-life balance doing OBGYN. Certainly the hours are not favorable as some specialties, but I think the rewards are, you know, extremely worthwhile. So.
Do you cover for each other every once in a while?
Of course.
Yeah, every day. Yeah.
So if you go through a whole pregnancy and expect to see one, you may end up seeing somebody else, right?
Exactly. We work as a group, and we very much like to explain that to the patients that at the time of delivery, any one of the providers could be there.
Uh-huh.
So we hope that the patients have basically built a relationship with all of us.
Uh-huh. And do you all see the patients from time to time when they come in, and so that they're all prepared for you?
Exactly. Yeah, so we certainly try to make that happen.
Oh, that was a great word. Could you just say that one more time? Exactly. I love that accent. Okay. Okay. Let's go. Oh, thanks a lot. So we just somebody.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for
thanks
answering
for
my question.
Bye. Okay. And we'll go to Julie in Sussex, New Jersey, where I once was a counselor at a camp. Go ahead. Julie.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to know about postmenopausal bleeding. I had a hysterectomy 9 years ago, and should I be concerned?
Definitely, I would certainly reach out and speak to your local provider. Many times we see patients for a different variety of things that could cause the bleeding,
right.
And it's a very individual thing, but I would certainly I'd reach out and speak to your nearest provider.
I did. I went, and then she did a urinalysis, but she said since everything was taken out, she didn't see a problem because I had a full hysterectomy.
So there are many reasons that you could be having the bleeding. Certainly, it appears that they looked for one, including a urinary infection. But certainly, there will be other things that I would look for, including things like dryness or like atrophy or...
Dryness and atrophy are two you just mentioned. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, okay. You can have bleeding from many different areas in the genitourinary tract, from the bladder, as you mentioned yourself, from the vagina itself, from the vulva. So there's lots of different areas, even after a hysterectomy, that can cause bleeding.
Okay. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to take a very short break. We will be right back.
Comes from Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, preparing students for careers in healthcare, business, education, social services, and more. Admissions open house Sunday, January 31st at 9:30 a.m., msmc.edu. Nathan LaTower Hospital proudly introducing the gastroenterology specialist of LaTower with Dr. Alvarez, Dr. Ramani, and Dr. Rahman, nlh.org. The Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians offering urologic oncology services with prostate specialists using active monitoring protocols, including imaging and genomic testing, urologyoncology.com. Colby Attorney Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939, colbyservice.com. And from Coldman Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years, cnharchitects.com.
And we are back with Drs. Malcolm Payne and Kimberly Sampson, obstetrician gynecologist practicing at South Western Vermont Medical Center in Bennington. Okay, guys, so the phones are still ringing, 1-800-348-2551. All right, and number two will be Sue from Boston something. Okay, Sue, you're on.
I have a question in regard to growth in the vaginal area. They're like bumps. I've had it checked with my gynecologist. She said they were glandular, and it seems like there's nothing, I guess, you can do for a situation like this unless they become infected. And it seems like they're larger, and I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly, but I didn't know whether it's real concern or there's just this is something that happens as you get older or maybe younger. I don't know, but that's my question.
Well, thanks for calling. That's a good question. I mean, once again, it's difficult to know without an examination when patients are complaining of various symptoms. There are lots of skin conditions in the vulva and the vagina that can cause bumps there. There are glands as in that skin as there are in any area of skin, such as in your armpit or anywhere else. And various growths can arise, and some of them are benign and not concerning, and some of them certainly can be of concern. So I would definitely recommend, if you think they're getting larger, that would probably be something to see your doctor for, or if you're concerned, you could have a second opinion as well.
So to what degree is there a difference between seeing your primary provider, if you're a woman with this kind of concern, or a gynecologist?
I think to some degree it depends on the relationship you have with your primary provider. There are many excellent primary providers who have a great deal of experience in gynecologic conditions, and they give excellent advice.
Mm. Well, this was my gynecologist, and it just seems that they're like just like bumps, and I've never had this before, and until just this summer actually, and. But it seems like they are getting larger. So would a provider do a biopsy?
That's sometimes an option. It, again, it depends on the clinical situation. It depends on what the examination findings are. I would definitely encourage you, if you think they're getting larger, definitely to seek advice from somebody, either the same provider, and go back to them and say, I'm concerned, or seek a second opinion from another provider.
Okay.
Sue, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, Rachel in Cobleskill. Okay, Rachel, you're on.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Rachel.
So I'm calling regarding, I'm currently nursing a one-year-old, and I seem to have, since I started nursing, been experiencing some hormone issues that my gynecologist did think was associated with having low estrogen related to nursing. And since the baby is older, I've been considering reducing the amount of nursing we're doing, and I'm assuming that might resolve some of the issues. But I was hoping to get your opinion on that and to ask if you had any other recommendations.
Well, thank you. It's an excellent question. I basically applaud you for making it 1 year. That's a fantastic achievement with the nursing. Certainly, as the your baby is getting older and sort of being introduced to newer foods, it's definitely an option. But weaning has to be a very individual case. Certainly, it may provide you with some of resolution with some of the symptoms that you're having. But again, there's new ones that arise with weaning as well. So basically something that you would very much need to sort of consider and discuss with your provider.
Yeah, I'm not planning to wean him entirely. I just assume that if he was nursing less, that the hormone issues might be resolved, but I'm not sure if that's the case.
There's always that possibility, but there's other options that it could be maybe associated with something else as well. So something that we need to sort of do a trial.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 from this vast area that constitutes WAMC land. Stephanie in Hyde Park. Stephanie. You're on.
Hi, this is Stephanie. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just had a question. I'm 6 months pregnant, and it's hard for me to stay away from my cup of coffee in the morning. And I'm just wondering if it's okay to still have a cup of coffee, if I should completely stop, or what should I do?
Well, that's a great question. It's certainly one we get asked all the time. The current recommendations are that a small amount of caffeine is safe. It's often something of a balance, and patients are able to cut down to some degree, but you don't have to completely quit caffeine. It's not like the current recommendations for alcohol, where we say definitely no alcohol is best, but a small amount of caffeine is deemed to be safe at this point.
Would it be safer to have none? I mean, you know, the thing I always love about all these studies and everything is, first you get the recommendation, and then after a million people do something for a while, you get the answer that maybe that wasn't right. So would you be better drinking a glass of water and not having a cup of coffee?
I don't think there's any evidence to say that you have to have zero caffeine in pregnancy. And I think many patients would find that really difficult to completely quit.
Well, difficult.
I think it's all about a balance. I think a small amount is a reasonable practice.
Small amount? Like one cup, half cup?
Yeah, one cup a day.
Steph,
all right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
That's a good question, because I'm sure a lot of people, you know, go through that and wonder about it. Okay, we'll go to Iris in New Paltz. Iris, you're on.
Hi, hello. Hello, doctors.
Hi.
Hello. I have a daughter who is going to be 18 in April, and she had lost her menstrual cycle about a year and a half ago due to a sudden weight loss and maybe exercise, but it's been a year and a half, and I've heard mixed results from an endocrinologist, also an OB, around whether or not she should go on a birth control pill because of the concern about bone loss, especially at this age where bone development is at its highest and peaks, they said, at around 25. So there was a concern, and her estrogen level is very low. And she's doing everything to get it back, but it hasn't come back yet. So we're struggling with whether or not she should go on the pill because of the bone issue.
Well, thanks. That's a great question. Thank you for calling. I would think I would probably agree that generally if there's a concern that patients are have lost their periods because of a low estrogen level, and that can be because of many different causes, and one is if a patient is underweight or if they're exercising to a large degree, if they're a athlete and training very hard, then low estrogen certainly is a concern if in terms of bone loss. So I think it's definitely something to discuss, you know, with the providers that she has seen, because often that it can be the right option for patients to get some estrogen supplement by way of a birth control pill. Yes.
Well, let me go back to the estrogen thing, because I haven't been following this very closely. But for a while, estrogen was a no-no, right? I mean, too much estrogen was a no-no for people, and if they had it, there were consequences, including some theories about cancer. Yes.
Well, certainly too much estrogen postmenopausally is a great concern if patients are on that for a long period of time. And also in terms of birth control pills, many years ago we used to have birth control pills with much higher doses of estrogen, which would have other health risks. But generally speaking, the birth control pills that are available today have very safe doses of estrogen. They've been tested on millions of women and are known to be very safe.
Now, speaking of which, I recently heard about testosterone, not only in men, but in women. Do you guys deal with that at all? They're looking at each other.
Again, it's a slightly controversial issue. The evidence is somewhat mixed in terms of testosterone treatment for women, and there's certainly risks that come with that.
Sure.
So it'd definitely be something I'd encourage patients to talk with their provider one-on-one about that.
Okay. Iris, anything else?
Well, the endocrinologist had two different opinions. One thought that there was no evidence to really support that if a woman isn't menstruating, that actually there was bone loss during those years, even with low estrogen. And the other one had a different opinion. So it's a little bit of a concern to hear conflicting reports.
Sure.
And it's not just estrogen. She has to go on a birth control pill. She has to take progesterone as well, even though it's just the estrogen that's low. So that was my concern, because it seems like the evidence wasn't clear.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's difficult to know without knowing the, you know, all the details about the patient, you know, your daughter. I think I would definitely, if you have concerns, I would discuss it with your daughter and with the providers as well, and just try and kind of dig further into to their concerns about that.
Yeah, but that really does sort of get to you when you've got two different doctors and they give and they give you conflicting advice. Then you're not the practitioner, and you know what do you do then? You just have to take your best shot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly difficult, and it may be, you know, there's many areas we still unfortunately don't have all the answers, unfortunately. So
yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Okay, Iris, thanks for the great call.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll go to Jen in Newburg. Hi, Jen, you're on.
Hi, I'm 40 years old, and I've been suffering from severe insomnia for about a year now. Doctors seem to want to medicate me rather than investigate the cause, and I'm just wondering if this is common, and could it be related to hormones, and if so, how do I ask for a test, or how do I go about figuring out the cause?
Hi, Jen. That's a great question. We certainly see insomnia for many different reasons. And like you mentioned, one of them could be hormonally related. We certainly do see it as a common symptom when somebody is what we call perimenopausal. That's sort of the stage running up to menopause. Sort of you may have heard of the familiar things like hot flashes, for instance. But insomnia is definitely part of that. But as I said before, there's other reasons as well. And so we sort of need to treat you as a whole and as an individual, and would certainly recommend speaking with a provider to figure out exactly what is going on.
And so there's no type of blood test or something that I could ask for?
So there's a number of different blood tests that we do perform through the perimenopausal stage, looking at different things in regards to the insomnia itself. There isn't one in particular that springs to mind. But again, we would need to speak with you as a whole and figure out any other issues that you may be having going on at that time.
Well, is there any relief? I mean, is there anything she could do, a pill or medicine that you've prescribed that sometimes, now we don't do that on this program, we're not prescribing, but are there treatments that people, that you might mention that some doctors prescribe for some of these conditions?
Well, Jen mentioned herself that that providers are often very quick to prescribe, and there's many other things that we can also be doing, looking into sort of her sleep hygiene and basically sort of looking at lifestyle changes that may also be made. There are obviously medications that can help, but that may not be first line.
And what about CPAP and the rest of that?
Again, a very, very separate sort of issue, and we would need to see sort of her on an individual basis and sort of tailor it that way.
I didn't mean to push around, you know. and Malcolm Payne, anything on that from you?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think sleep is a very complex issue. There's multiple different physiological and so physical factors and psychological factors. So it's a very complex issue, and certainly we wouldn't. We try not to jump straight into prescribing medication for people and tailor it more individually and see if there's other things that can be done first line before prescribing medication.
And Jen, you can call me up because I'll be up because I can't sleep either. Thank you very much for being with us. Well, that's it for today. Believe it or not, we're done. And I just want to thank some people. And Drs. Malcolm Payne and Kimberly Sampson for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from HPA LiveWell, Albany, New York, providing intensive outpatient psychological services for treatment of eating disorders and around the capital region, in and around the capital region, I should say, albanyhpa.com. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones, our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wmc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a news update. And before we go, let me just say the lockbox is open and ready to receive anything you can put into it. Go to wamc.org and say, I want to save my radio station. And there you'll be. Thank you so much. See you soon.